wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Sharon Grant, your host for Monday, November 22nd. This morning on the Old Mole, first, Bill Resnick asks his guest, Tina Gerhardt, a climate change researcher and journalist who observed the Glasgow conference, if we now have a binding agreement with enforcement and a doable plan for stopping global warming. No, was her answer, but some small gains were made and the protests outside were uniting around a feasible program. Next, in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker discuss recent judgments in a case brought by Chevron against environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger. Donziger represented indigenous Ecuadorians in their suit against Chevron for environmental damage from oil drilling in the Amazon. Jan and Mike talk about the significance of this case for indigenous rights and the international fight against big oil. We'll conclude with Sarah Chivers, who speaks with Sarah Hickman, a palliative caregiver and social worker in Vancouver. They discuss structural problems in our healthcare system, the labor conditions faced by healthcare workers, and the toll of crisis work on workers on the front lines during a pandemic. I'm Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website at kboo.fm/omvh, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Tina Gerhardt discussing what's next after COP26, followed by a little bit of music called Orca's Surprise by Jada G.
Tina Gerhardt, welcome to KBOO.
Great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation, Bill.
Tina Gerhardt has a distinguished career teaching and writing in cultural studies, much on film and critical theory. And then along came looming environmental threats to human life. She kept teaching, but turned to environmental journalism, researching and writing, publishing in many U.S. magazines, including The Nation and Sierra Club magazine. For the last several weeks, Tina Gerhardt's been in Glasgow, Scotland, observing the 26th United Nations Conference of the Parties. The first conference, it was in Rio de Janeiro. It had the lofty aim of uniting the world and planning what to do when it became clear that humanity, mostly in the developed industrialist countries, that we in the rich world, although must be said, most of us in the U.S. live hand to mouth and most precarious, but that, quote, rich countries were on a path to destroying the ecosystems upon which life depends. Now it's Conference 26, almost 30 years later. And in every one of those 29 years, greenhouse gas, near every one of those 29 years, greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise. Greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere have precipitously risen. And climate scientists now estimate that we have 8 years to take drastic action or risk calamity. Tina Gerhardt, before this 26th meeting of the parties, over 200 countries, in fact, the stakes were high in the conference. Several national leaders, including Joe Biden, called this, in quotes, the last best chance to save the planet. So, Tina, did our leaders and elites, did they finally turn the corner? Do we now have a binding agreement with enforcement and a doable plan for stopping global warming? What happened in Glasgow?
Yes, thanks for the invitation to give your listeners a bit more of a report back from COP26 in Glasgow. I think one of the things that's really important to know as setting a stage for, you know, context basically for what I'm going to say that follows is that this was intended by COP26 President Alok Sharma to be the most inclusive COP ever. And it wound up, it's been called the whitest and wealthiest UN climate negotiation. What I mean by that is that what's been referred to as vaccine apartheid, visa issues, and then just the prohibitive costs. I guess, you know, Airbnb and hotels were gouging people up to like $1,500 a night for hotel rooms. The combination of those factors prevented a lot of people, predominantly from the global south, from attending. And that really manifested in terms of who was on the ground, meaning activists, delegates, journalists. I think there was like a third of Pacific Islands had people in attendance. It really hit Latin American countries hard, and also Africa. So I think that's really important for context. But in terms of the takeaway, you know, I wrote in The Nation, the results were decidedly mixed. I think in terms of some of the upsides coming out of COP26, fossil fuels were mentioned for the first time, which might surprise listeners because that's the source of the climate crisis that we're in. And yet they don't get mentioned. They have been alluded to in the Kyoto Protocol. They were alluded to, and there was one other reference in a draft text, but they've never been in. So that's great. But the downside there is that even if they were referred to, it was really a watered down reference to them. So initially the call was for a phase out of coal and of fossil fuel subsidies. And then that ended up getting watered down twice, actually. One of the watered downs that people might have heard about in the main news that's already reported on this is the phase out. In a moment of high drama at the very end, went to a phase down. India, as they thought they were going to pass the Glasgow Climate Pact, as it came to be known, they spoke up and requested that phase out be changed to phase down. Now, that language of phase down is also in the U.S.-China agreement that was announced last week and kind of a beacon of hope. But, you know, I have questions about whether it's a beacon of hope if that language was also put forward, and China put it forward, if that was also there, right? It was supposed to be this moment, you know, the two nations working together where things move forward. But then India does this move where they call for a phase down instead of a phase out. The same language is used by China, and the U.S. went along with it. And they're all among the high coal-producing and consuming nations. So that was one downside in terms of the fossil fuels. The other thing that had a lot of attention was funding, so money. And I think for your listeners, the big picture here is this push for money really indicates two things. How intensely the global countries in the global south are already suffering and have been for the past decade. This isn't a new thing that just arrived on their coastlines, you know, like Hurricane Ida or the fires we've experienced last year. They've been experiencing these kinds of intense events for at least a decade. So that's the important framing for the funding. So they had two pieces of good news. They keep pushing for funding for what gets called adaptation. There's a lot of UN speak and a lot of acronyms at COP26. But what adaptation really means is basically that you need monies for things that will help you to respond to the impacts of climate change. So those could be things like seawalls, which I'm not a big fan of. They could also be things like managed retreat, or moving infrastructure or, you know, people inland, that's managed retreat, but also moving infrastructure inland. That wasn't getting enough monies, and they got more money from the UN this year via the COP26. The other kind of money that they're asking for is through a mechanism, again, this is UN language, called loss and damage. So loss and damage refers to intense impacts of climate change that were unpredictable and that have now created situations where you have loss and damage, for example, a hurricane, or if you don't want like something that's so quick, like a lightning flash, slower climate change impacts like drought or like sea level rise also count. Now, this one is really, really tricky. They didn't get money for it. They didn't even get what was called a facility, which would have been the thing through which they could have gotten money. They didn't even get that into the Glasgow Climate Pact. And the reason is this has also been referred to as climate reparations, and it really opens the door for forcing the global north to acknowledge their historical emissions, the historical inequities of those emissions, and to have to pay up for having created the situation that we're in. Now, the U.S. and the EU is vehemently opposed. They think this will expose them to future liability. And so instead of creating this thing that I mentioned earlier, which in UN speak was called a facility, they changed that word to dialogue. And islanders, you know, people from the global south, islands in the Pacific, members of the G77, which includes a lot of sub-Saharan African countries, they were just fuming. They were like, we don't need more dialogue and conversation, more blah, 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 as Greta Thunberg has put it. We actually need the money. We need action. So I think those are the three big takeaways. There's one other thing I'll add in terms of emissions. People came to the table, countries came to the table this year with emissions that were below the targets that are needed that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has put forward. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and this is in the Glasgow Climate Pact, which is great, they say that you need 45% of greenhouse gas emissions reductions based on 2010 levels by 2030, crucial decade for action is this decade, in order to keep global warming to 1.5. Islands always say 1.5 to stay alive. So of the G20 nations, which are responsible for 80% of emissions, only the EU has weighed in with a commitment that actually meets that. It actually exceeds what they offered, 55%. So all the other nations now have to come back next year that don't meet that target. They all have to come. It's like bad school children. If they haven't done their homework, they all have to come back next year with cuts and pledges that actually meet that target. And that's a good thing because previously out of the Paris Agreement, they had to come back every 5 years. But because, like I said, this decade by 2030 is the one for action, the realization is really that they have to report back every year. And that's a huge change. I mean, one of the things coming out of COP26 that I realized is it's, you know, as everyone can tell, it's a really unwieldy, complicated, slow, cumbersome, slow-moving animal, COP26. One of the reasons is because it works by consensus models, which not everyone is familiar with, but for your listeners who are or who have participated in leftist forums that use consensus, they'll know exactly why that would make it cumbersome. But it's, you know, in terms of temporal scale, the climate crisis is moving really quickly. It needs action this decade. And the UN is just maybe not the right vehicle because it only meets once a year, because it requires consensus, which is typically good. But it's too slow.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour here on KABU 90.7 FM Portland, talking to Tina Gerhardt, who teaches now mostly about the environment, and who attended the Glasgow International Conference on dealing with climate change. We've been discussing how this 26th annual meeting, they started in 1972, it had some promising initiatives, and at least including fossil fuel phase down, which is in fact what the corporations talk about, because they want it to be really slow so there's no stranded assets and so they can adjust and they don't have to change anything about the way they operate or their profit model. That is to maintain business as usual, which would include a phase down. There were a number of other provisions. Tina, in an article you wrote, The Problem with Net Zero, you wrote about the plans, that they were basically inadequate and many were completely phony, that is absurd. But it seems to me that just demanding a plan every year, if they're allowed to just make absurd claims, Microsoft, in fact, made an announcement that they were going to become net zero in a short amount of time through carbon sequestration. Well, that technology is completely unproven. Where they've done it, it's extremely expensive, and they don't know what to do with all of this carbon dioxide. They want to pump it into caves and stuff. It's hard to believe that Microsoft would do that, but I think most of the corporations, the whole of capitalism, just doesn't want to deal. If you want to have a livable planet, they have to completely reconstruct themselves, and I mean completely. Why don't you talk about the plans and why net zero is such a terrible idea, but it seems to be it's still prevalent.
So I wrote about net zero for Sierra, but I was also asked, at the invitation of my editors, I was also asked to write an article earlier this year by the editors of The Progressive. And the issue with net zero, and your listeners who want to dig into this a little bit more deeply, I would really recommend that they go to check out work by Corporate Accountability, which is an organization that has really been focusing on net zero and some of the fallacies in terms of its arguments. So the problems with net zero, the main problem for me is it kicks the can down the road, right? You hear at COP or in general, like when climate is mentioned with regard to net zero, you will typically hear net zero by 2050 or later. And like I said a number of times, this decade is the one for action. And action doesn't mean pie-in-the-sky pledges, doesn't mean pie-in-the-sky promises. It actually means policy in place and implemented, and that policy leading to action on the ground. Because policy in place can also be, you know, with this bill that just passed in the U.S. yesterday on infrastructure, a lot of the talk right away was, well, how long is it going to take to roll it out, right? So really action and concrete signs of emissions reductions this decade is what's needed, not pie-in-the-sky ideas. So net zero, I think, is really a delay tactic in order to kick the can down the road, in order to not have to take action. That's on the part of governments. It's also on the part of corporations. And some of the problems that Corporate Accountability did study together with the Sierra Club. And one of the things that they found is that some of what is put forward to lead to net zero by 2050 is just, it's fiction. You know, they have this article, it's called The Big Con, How Polluters Are Advancing a Net Zero Climate Agenda to Delay, Deceive, and Deny. And, you know, they found in that report the corporations are spending lavishly to lobby and undermine progress towards real solutions and real zero. But it's a lot of it is just based on fictions. There's also human rights concerns involved with net zero and relations, again, between global north and global south. And what I mean by that is offsets are part of net zero, which has been bandied about for ages and is hugely problematic. So forests in the global south get used, you know, a corporation or a nation says, okay, well, Indonesia, if you give us part of your forest, we won't chop it down, and then we'll get to say that we've reduced our emissions. Now, that might sound fine, but in terms of human rights violations, some of these kinds of agreements might lead to land grabs. So the global north is grabbing land from the south. It might lead to the movements of people off of those lands, which is where the human rights violations come in. But most of all, for me, is the concern that it's just too far down the road. We need concrete action now, and even policies, you know, there's a lag between policies and implementation. And that brings me back to one of your points in the opening. We are really at a moment where we're seeing the limits of this current economic system. I mean, it's being pushed up against in terms of the funding demands I mentioned at the outset. I call this, you know, fancy math, like any fancy math tricks. Math tricks aren't going to fool science, right? It just needs to be action. So we're really seeing the limits of this economic model, and time will tell, but I think all of the actions that work not only to address the climate crisis, but really to retool our economies in a way that ensures equity, be it within our communities, you know, domestically, sub-states of domestically, you know, at state level, local level, community level, or even global equity between nations. I mean, that's really what this moment demands. And it also really demands that we rethink our relationship to nature, not only as a resource, you know, which viewing it as a carbon sink basically is viewing it as a resource to solve our problems, but really viewing it as something that we need to live in harmony with very differently than we have.
Tina Gerhardt, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation, truly, Bill. I'm so grateful that you're doing this work.
I'm grateful you're doing your work. Keep up the good work. Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mill Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Tina Gerhardt. She left a scholarly life to teach research and write about the destruction of the ecosystems upon which life depends. Tina Gerhardt observed at the classical UN conference that just ended. The conference started in 1992. Since then, there's been 26 of them. They've accomplished very little, basically kicking the can down the road. At the 26th conference that just ended, over 200 countries submitted estimates of their greenhouse gas emissions and also submitted their plan for eliminating those emissions. Unfortunately, as you just heard, nearly every country undercounted their emissions, fabricating the numbers, and their plans were full of technological solutions that, even if they worked, they are not proven, and even if they were proven to work, they presented great dangers. That was discussed in part one of the interview. Tina and I will be doing part two next week, discussing what the nations of the world must do to avert the looming catastrophe, a catastrophe, again, that could well result in human extinction. Physics is relentless. Keep doing what we have been doing. Temperatures will soar to make the planet uninhabitable. Next week, Tina and I will discuss what could be done to save the planet.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 Portland Community Radio. Next, you'll hear Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker discuss recent judgments in a case brought by Chevron in a New York City federal court against environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger, who represented indigenous Ecuadorians in their suit against Chevron for environmental damage from oil drilling in the Amazon.
Mike, in a previous Left in the Law segment, we took up the case of Stephen Donziger, the New York lawyer who pursued Chevron for its contamination of the Ecuadorian Amazon and helped win a multi-billion-dollar verdict against Chevron in 2011. After that ruling, Chevron pulled its assets out of Ecuador and fought back by bringing racketeering charges against Donziger in federal courts in the U.S. And last month, Donziger started a six-month prison term after a federal judge in New York City found him guilty of criminal contempt of court. Well, Mike, can you summarize Chevron's case against Donziger, which some legal observers say has some merit? Was he a righteous warrior for justice who somehow lost his way in the legal jungle where he found himself?
Well, Jen, I think the existence of that dichotomy is proof of Chevron's success in their effort to, quote, demonize Donziger. That's been their strategy from the start. The judgment against him was obtained primarily from the testimony of a witness who Chevron paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. The irony is here that the real criminal activity, the real racketeering conspiracy, which are charges of which Donziger was convicted, took place on the part of Chevron's attorneys, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher.
I mean, isn't that it's a common legal strategy to turn the tables on whatever party has pressed charges against you to kind of reverse? It's kind of a legal version of projection.
Yeah, it's if you look carefully at the charges of which he was convicted, they evaporate. You know, they basically, at first Chevron thought they would overturn the judgment as a sham, but basically they could not do that. There were over 2,000 soil samples showing pollution. There was
even setting aside the question of whether one of the experts was bought off. I mean, there was a quite a sizable set of sources of evidence to support that claim. Is that right?
Well, yeah, the expert that was supposedly bought off was not considered by the judge. His testimony was irrelevant. So whether or not he was bought off, the actual evidence that was the basis of the decision did not involve anything that he said. There were a large number of experts as well as local community members and a huge record supporting the judgment. And Chevron basically abandoned their effort to overturn that part of the judgment, and they went after Donziger. They did so by bringing racketeering charges against him.
Which is a bit unusual, right? This is...
It's totally unusual. They couldn't get a prosecutor.
With the mafia.
Yeah, they couldn't get a prosecutor to raise those charges. But the judge was determined to nail Donziger. So he succeeded in getting a private law firm appointed, one that had worked previously for Chevron. So people who were actually at the trial describe it as bizarre. There was a huge space given over to Chevron and all their counsel, and Donziger was practicing in a closet. It was a massive opinion, a 497-page opinion, that basically concluded three things: that this one expert, Cabrera, had been bribed, also efforts of bribery of the guy who actually wrote the opinion, who's a Judge Zambrano, and finally, efforts to bribe Zambrano. Nobody disputes that no money changed hands. These are all charges based on obscure shipping records about who might have had something at some point. And I think the most dramatic thing that's happened is that Chevron also tried to arbitrate this case. There's an international arbitration board that deals strictly with commercial law. It's very powerful. Like if Uruguay, for example, wanted to make selling cigarettes illegal, tobacco companies went to this international board and got a ruling saying that Ecuador could not do that. They're in many ways more powerful than nation states. But the governor of Ecuador has considerable resources. So in that arbitration hearing, they ended up presenting testimony from the witness upon whom Judge Kaplan relied. And that witness, Alguera, basically said he had lied, that the Chevron had assisted his relocation from Ecuador. He was broke at the time. He couldn't afford to come see his kids in the United States. They paid him $326,000, and he not only admitted having been paid massive amounts of money by Chevron, but he admitted that his testimony about who had ghostwritten what was a lie. And yet that testimony is the pillar, remains the pillar of not only the RICO judgment against Donziger, but also later of his disbarment in New York and every other bad thing that's happened to him.
I think part of what's disturbing and confusing about this drama is not the aggressiveness of this Chevron's battalion of lawyers coming up against this, you know, band of guerrilla fighters on Donziger's side, but that a number of the legal community have sided with Chevron on this. The fact that he was disbarred in the state of New York seemed to give weight to Chevron's charges against him of corruption, and though some of this was based on the rulings of this judge against him, his refusal to hand over a computer with his contacts. But how do you understand his disbarment? What was that about, given all of what you just described, that on the face of it, even if you don't read the 500-page report, looks pretty fishy?
Well, the disbarment proceedings took place before a referee named John Horan, and he wrote a passionate opinion that Donziger should not be disbarred. He should be allowed to continue practicing law. But there was an appellate body, and the appellate body refused to accept Horan's recommendation. And, you know, a really great lawyer, Martin Garbus, who was appointed by Jimmy Carter to go observe Venezuela elections, he was a lawyer in Goldberg v. Kelly and big due process cases in the 70s and 80s. He has worked with Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia drafting their constitution. He reviewed this document and said, This perfunctory decision reads like it was written by a Soviet-era apparatchik carrying out a political function to help a major corporation get rid of its main critic, which is just what it does.
So is this case against Donziger and his series of defeats that led him to be in prison and starting a prison, 6-month prison term last month, is it symptomatic of the influence of the fossil fuel industry or big oil on our legal system?
Of course. You know, they do what they need to do. If it's a small matter, they'll not expend many resources to oppose it. But Doniger dealt them a serious blow. It was the atrocities in Ecuador, the poisoning of hundreds of square miles, was done by Texaco, who basically admitted what they had done, which is simply never try to carefully dispose of any of their waste, thus poisoning rivers, wells, water of all kinds. What Doniger's judgment said was
and just
that,
to explain, Chevron bought out Texaco and inherited its liability problems, right?
Exactly. So it looked to me like, well, Chevron overpaid for Texaco because they've got this $9 billion judgment. So Chevron has marshaled every resource they've got, and they have more resources than God. In the United States, the fossil fuel industry basically dominates the entire agenda, politically, even spiritually, by ads, morally, certainly, legally. Judges, the judge Lewis Kaplan, who presided over this case, was a former tobacco industry lawyer. The depth of Chevron's penetration into the shaping of this country's laws and mores is incalculable. Only now, as fossil fuels are coming under really serious examination, is that beginning to waver. But we see how the purchase of Joe Manchin by these fossil fuel companies is going to block likely legislation that would lead to undermining them with supporting various alternate forms of energy. I think what's happened is that they are shooting so hard now because in truth, that judgment lives. If Donziger can get to a country that will recognize that judgment, which was not in any way undercut by the RICO finding against Donziger himself, then...
And that's why the judgment itself seems to have been very much sidelined by all of the focus on Donziger and kind of procedural issues of
exactly
how he went about the case. I want to, before we stop with our discussion of the case of Stephen Donziger, the David against this massive Goliath of Chevron, what about the Ecuadorian people who still contend with massive unremediated oil pollution? They have not received compensation, even though, as you say, that initial claim that produced the settlement was not itself overturned. Are there lessons here about how once you take on the global fight of big oil, you can just drown in this stuff? And is it worth the fight, or is there anything strategically to learn from this for attorneys or legal teams that are fighting big oil?
Perseverance furthers. I think this case is only beginning, Jen. I think Donziger is going to get out of prison in 6 months. There's a very good chance, given the general shift of opinion in Europe and around the world against fossil fuel, growing recognition that it's killing us, it's burning us up, that he will ultimately prevail. I think he's done remarkably well. The opinions about him now have never been more favorable. If he can just hang on, and I think he will, he looks like a stubborn, tough dude, then I believe that the shift of general sentiment around the world is moving in his direction and is moving away from Chevron. So the only lesson I can think of is keep on keeping on.
Okay. And the fight in the global South is in some ways more severe, the fight around the global warming and the climate crisis, but there is also perhaps a moral responsibility in the global north, and particularly in more protected areas, to see this as a larger fight to save the planet and support these cases.
Yeah, there are thousands of Ecuadorian women, men, children who were either killed or had their lives destroyed by Texaco and now Chevron's deliberate destruction of their countryside. That should not be overlooked. That should be really closely looked at. That should be accepted, and we should never look away.
And you're saying that if you get caught in the minutiae of the procedural questions raised, that perhaps any team of attorneys with enough resources can raise enough doubt about the other side and proceedings, that this, when you looked at the legal evidence against Donziger and his legal team, it didn't amount to much, that a lot of this was part of the process any legal team embarks on when you're putting a case together.
Yeah, they were excellent litigators, but to the extent that people believe it's a close call, there's on the one hand, blada, blada, but on the other hand, blada, blada.
Right.
Chevron has already won. I mean, it's really a relatively straightforward. Chevron committed atrocious acts in the Amazon. They were caught for doing it. Now they've managed to demonize the person who articulated just exactly what they had done and who got some small recompense for the tragedy of what happened.
Yeah. They are trying to mutilate the messenger.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's continue to follow this case. You're saying it's not over, but you're saying it's a worthy fight, because not all fights are worth the energy that has and resources invested in them. And there is a concern that Stephen Donziger himself has become the central protagonist on the stage with Chevron, and that this has marginalized Ecuadorian people who still suffer under the effects of the oil drilling there. But you're saying the fight is still an important fight.
Well, yeah, Chevron's first tactic was to say the lawsuit was a sham, that this damage never really happened. But when it became overwhelmingly obvious that, yes, it had happened, these people did suffer, this land was destroyed or damaged for decades, then their strategy became demonize Donziger. And that's currently what's happening.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Mike, we'll return to this and follow it as it unfolds. You're saying that Chevron has and the federal court in New York does not have the final word on this. It has not. There's no clear denouement to the story at this point.
Nope.
Okay. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the case of Stephen Donziger as the David coming up against the Goliath of Chevron Company.
That was Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking about the significance of this case for indigenous rights in the international fight against big oil. The music was a piece called Tinko from the album Traditional Music from the Incas. You've been listening to KBOO-FM. Next up, you'll hear Sarah Chivers speak with Sarah Hickman, a palliative caregiver and social worker in Vancouver. They discuss how the pandemic has magnified problems in our healthcare system, the labor conditions faced by healthcare workers, the toll of crisis work on workers on the front lines, and how it all affects care, particularly for the most vulnerable patients.
I'm speaking today with Sarah Hickman, a social worker in palliative care who works in healthcare systems in the Portland metropolitan area, Vancouver, and in Cowlitz County. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about end-of-life care work during the pandemic.
Yeah, no problem.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like to be working with people at the end of their life during the pandemic.
I think a lot has changed in the last couple years since COVID hit. I think end-of-life care is different in a lot of ways. We're working in a system that was already taxed quite a bit prior to hitting the pandemic, and the pandemic really magnified a lot of the challenges that the healthcare system already had in place. Some of the ways that people are impacted are families are not getting the care they're needing, and a lot of our patients are dying faster than they used to. Some of our patients are waiting long periods of time to get caregiving support. We ran out of hospital beds at one point. We've ran out of oxygen. Our patients can't see the doctors anymore that they need to see to get follow-up care. The surgeries are all canceled, and a lot of people are really stressed, so the mental health of our community is really stretched thin. And changes are wide-ranging, and I think we aren't going to even know the impact of how things have changed for end-of-life care for a very long time. And palliative care has changed in a lot of ways because we're having conversations with folks around whether or not they want to be intubated or whether they want to have certain types of treatments. And there's a lot of conversations with folks about providing care in the community versus the hospital. That's been a huge change. People are not really going into the hospital anymore as much as they used to. I think people are scared to seek treatment. There's a lot of people that are frightened. They're scared that they're going to not be able to see their loved one if they go into the hospital. And so I'm part of an outpatient group of folks right now. My role works in a lot of the homes and facilities around here, and I'm starting to see a lot of insurance companies provide outpatient care. So I roam around and help and support folks in the community, and so is a lot of these insurance companies. So I've noticed a lot of people getting additional supports from outfits like Humana. They have their own visiting nurse practitioner team that comes out and sees people. And it's really interesting because no one's communicating with each other. So I might go visit a patient, and so does multiple other providers, and we aren't talking to each other. And so what does that mean for the patient, their continuity of care? What does that mean for their outcomes, right? Is if we're all doing different things, or we're all redoing the same work, is that a good use of services? Are we good being good stewards of our resources? So it's magnified some of the challenges and the disorganization that's taking place. And I'm in my 30s, and so I'll probably be supporting an aging population that's going to be booming here in another 10 years. And so I'm really nervous. We don't have people to care for the folks that are aging. So It's a scary time, but it has changed a lot of how people are seeking care and what that care looks like.
We know there were already issues, holes, and weaknesses in our healthcare system, and it sounds like COVID has really magnified those issues and placed much greater system level constraints on you and the frontline workers who've been almost for 2 years now just working exhausting hours with less resources to work with and higher demand. It seems there's just this incredible increase in demand for healthcare services across the board. How has that shaped your job? Are you finding that you're doing different things now as a social worker than before the pandemic? You had to acquire a whole new set of skills and do services outside of palliative care because of the demands of COVID on our healthcare system?
Sure. It's really just crisis work, right? It's not, you know, having conversations and drinking tea anymore and discussing what you want the end of life care to look like. It's people who are struggling at home. Just last week, I drove 45 minutes to a man's home to bring him water bottles. His wife and him live alone. They don't have kids. And he had fallen and hurt himself a month and a half prior. And his wife fell over the weekend. And now she was hospitalized. And he told me, you know, I just can't bring water to my recliner with my walker because I can't hold the water bottle and use my walker. And there was no one to help him. And he hadn't showered in a while. And his wife was the one that was helping him prior. And it's just those basic things. So I drove a case of water out to him and left it next to his recliner where he was going to sit. But it wasn't like that before. We could have hired a caregiver. This family has money, so they could have hired a caregiver, but there just wasn't people that we could hire at that point. So his wife had been looking for someone, but they just didn't have, and they live out in the rural areas, so that's part of what happens is our rural communities are obviously going to be hit first and hardest. They're struggling to get people to go out and care for folks who are living and aging in our community out in the rural areas. And then it, you know, trickles down. We see a lot of our minority population being impacted differently. They are left behind because when crisis work takes place, we just know when people are in crisis, they're not thinking, oh, maybe we should put this information in multiple languages. Maybe we should, you know, find ways to communicate to people.
So accessibility is a huge issue.
Mm-hmm. And when you're doing crisis work, people are in crisis mode, and so they don't do those extra pieces. They don't think about the ways you can, you know, make things equal because things are so stressed and stretched thin. So, you know, there's times when people may not understand their choices that they're making. They may not understand how to access the resources. They may not know what's available to them. And it's all because of how things are distributed. We expect people to log into their healthcare website, make an attempt to communicate with their doctors via this healthcare online tool. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have internet or you don't have, you know, access to a smartphone or a device that can upload it in the way that we have it set up, then you're not going to be able to do that. And then you're tasked with calling your doctor's office. And I know because I spend a lot of time calling doctor's offices that you sit on hold for 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. And some people tell us hours when they're Medicaid and they're low income and they're going to see CMAR or one of our Medicaid providers, they don't have people to answer the phones. They don't have staffing.
So there's real structural barriers to accessibility for people in rural areas, for people who don't have their children or other adults in their community to provide support for basic needs. Mm-hmm. And so your role from beyond giving palliative care to people who are trying to end their life in a good way with dignity and support are having to really feel the shock of this because it sounds like there's not really enough workers to fill all the caregiving roles now because we've got such a high demand of people needing care. What does that look like in the hospital setting? You had mentioned to me before that you worked 33 days in a row recently and that you were doing jobs that people who had been part of the Great Resignation, part of the millions of workers in the U.S. over the last few months who've quit their jobs, you're filling those holes. So what's that like for you in the hospital setting?
In the hospital setting, it's a different monster. There's not a lot of people covering shifts, so people are stressed out. Every department is stressed out. Most of the folks that are working have been doing the same thing I've been doing, covering extra shifts. There's a lot of extra money kind of floating around, but it's not given out equally, so everybody's pissed off at each other and pitted against one another. We have traveling providers coming in and they're making double what you're making, and it doesn't feel good because you're the one that's working for the system and putting in all the extra time to stay on and following through with all the requirements that they're putting in place now. And so there's a lot of, you know, things that are different for a lot of people. And one of the ways we help out in hospital settings is letting families have access to their loved ones. They aren't allowed to go in and say goodbye. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. It really just depends on the situation. specifically for me, my role would change based off of what the need was. So I work both hospice and palliative care and in multiple hospital settings. So when I work hospice in the hospital, it's really overwhelming. Part of the role is kind of figuring out why someone's dying, and there's COVID on board or multiple different things going on and someone's very sick. It can be very stressful. And what has happened is the hospitals that I'm working in, a third of the population is referred for palliative care, and then they have really large lists of hospice patients. So if you're just one employee and you have, you know, 30 patients that you need to see that are all dying, you know that there's probably going to be about five or six of those that are just going to die and you're not going to have any interaction with. And so what I see is that people are missing the care that they need. And when you have a loved one dying in the hospital and you don't know what's going on, and someone, there's not enough people to call you and tell you what's going on. And I have heard families say, I've called multiple times to find out how my mom is, and no one's told them and no one's called them back. And it's because the nurse is running her hiney off just trying to meet the needs of the patients and take care of them. And so, you know, it's overwhelming and stressful for the people in those settings. And if you do that work day in and day out, it is trauma work. It's like working in a trauma setting. And there needs to be specific trauma therapy at that point for those workers, because we're going to see long-term mental health effects from the people doing this. And the people that know how to protect themselves and get through the work are the ones that are going to be able to stay in it long-term. But that's why we're seeing so many people leave, is that they don't have the coping skills to protect themselves through constant trauma. And who does?
And the workplace doesn't have the supports for workers who need to do basic self-care and not work 33 days in a row.
Well, and a lot of us aren't thinking clearly, right? There's not a lot of, you know, people are having sleep issues. They're having just basic, trying to make their basic needs met. The pandemic has impacted a lot of the people's personal lives. And so when you're mentally not doing well, and then you're expected to work and be the same worker you were before in an environment that's completely different, the stress is higher, and people who pick that up.
You've mentioned that your workplace isn't unionized, but we've talked before about how there are other health systems that have unionized workers, Kaiser, for example. And Kaiser unions are part of the big Striketober movement of, there's up to 50,000 healthcare workers nationally who are trying right now to bargain for a reasonable contract, and one that doesn't create this two-tier system of workers where the new hires get the same kinds of working conditions, but even less compensation from hospital CEOs. If you were to write a letter with your colleagues and your peers right now to the hospital CEO where you work, what would you say you need in order to continue to help people die with dignity and have their family members supporting them and have their basic needs met?
I would say that I think equal pay is really important. I think it feels bad to have people making twice as much doing the same job alongside you. And I think that, you know, making sure that your employees are well cared for is really important. A lot of our lives have changed and have been impacted financially. There's things that have changed for all of us, and money does help make those things, you know, alleviate problem. So I am a huge fan of those bonuses that they've been giving out to the nurses. But the thing is that this is just the beginning, and I don't know how long you can just give out bonuses to people. So creating structural change is going to have to, you know, start at the top, and it has to start with our healthcare system as a whole. And we're going to need to implement a Medicare for all system. It's just how it's going to have to be. We don't have the skill set to take care of an aging population.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing about your work, especially the care work that you do for folks during the pandemic. You are an essential frontline worker that's keeping us all going, and I just really want to honor the work that you've done and what you've shared with us today. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
In the still of the night, in the world's ancient light, where wisdom grows up in strife, my bewildered brain toils in vain, through the darkness on the pathways of life. Each invisible prayer is like a cloud in the air. Tomorrow keeps turning around. We live and we die, we know not why, but I'll be with you when the deal goes down.
That was Bob Dylan's song, When the Deal Goes Down. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour, which comes to you every Monday morning at 9 a.m. That concludes our program for today. Thanks to Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, Mike Snedeker, and Sarah Chivers for making this show possible. And a thank you to guests Tina Gerhardt and Sarah Hickman. And a very big thanks to John Nelson for his help in producing the show today. KABU is a nonprofit organization, and 80% of our funding comes from our members. Won't you become part of that effort by contributing? Just go to kabu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, and you can always mail a contribution to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. Turn in next Monday at 9 a.m. to the Old Mole for more news, reviews, and views from Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up and movements from below. As always, you can find the podcast of the show online in a day or two on our website at kabu.fm. We also invite you to like us on Facebook and to follow us at The Old Mole on Twitter. This is Sharon Grant for The Old Mole Variety Hour.